Well, it's really good to be here this morning to see all your faces again. And whenever Leslie reaches out, I always want to say, yes, I'd love to come, and at the same time wonder, what in the world do I have to offer? Words seem to fall so short these days. But as always, these stories come forward from Central America that I want to bring and share. These amazing human beings who persevere in the most challenging of times, thrive in the midst of adversity, and create a better future. So for these challenging times, I bring some Thrive stories. The last time I was here, I was talking about gun violence in the United States, about my sister, who was a victim, about intergenerational and collective trauma, and about the domination paradigm that we live in. And today, I want to talk about a different paradigm, the one we need to get to change this reality. A recent teacher that I've circled back to is Pat McCabe, a Native American woman, activist, writer, and ceremonial leader. And she talks about the Thrive paradigm as an antidote to the domination paradigm. She says that humanity is a traumatized species because the domination paradigm is inherently violent, and that we need to enter a paradigm that is life-affirming. She says that in her cosmology, every single life form has a seat on the sacred hoop of life and contributes to the thriving of all others. Every life form upholds its part of the hoop, and if any life form does not uphold its part, the hoop loses its integrity. She says all are necessary to uphold the harmony of the hoop, but we no longer know what it is to be a human being or how to uphold our part. We only know how to be a human being in a power over paradigm, but we can be completely different human beings. She says the big question for our time is, how can I be that human being that lives in such a way that my life supports our collective thriving? So I know you all are looking at big questions. So here's another one to look at. We'll look at this a little today. And right now, when I make a quick look around, I see that collectively we are not thriving. What stands out in this country are the mass shootings. Just this year, Buffalo, New York, Uvalde, Highland Park, Chicago. So far, by the beginning of August, there were 410 mass shootings so far this year. That's an average of 13 mass shootings per week. And according to the Gun Violence Archive, they are increasing in frequency and severity. One half of all the civilian guns in the whole world are in the hands of people here in the United States, and we are 4% of the world's population. Whistleblower insiders from the arms industry say that the industry deliberately cultivates toxic masculinity to sell assault weapons and fuel domestic terrorism. And yet, Congress has yet to pass a ban on assault weapons. The Supreme Court expanded gun rights within weeks of some of the most severe mass shootings, and then proceeded to strip women of essential rights and threatens to criminalize contraception, marriage equality, LGBTI rights. The weapons industry employs 700 lobbyists, that's more than one for every member of Congress, spends millions on campaign contributions, and drives up our military budget. It's over $800 billion this year. That's the biggest in the world. It's bigger than the next 9 highest military spenders in the world combined. Fires, floods scream their warnings, and our president cannot fall short of declaring a climate emergency. This is domination system. It produces collective trauma. There is inherent violence in it, and it breaks the sacred hoop. We forget what it is to be a human being. Thomas Hubel, who is a teacher of collective trauma and healing processes, says that collective trauma and shadow is our unintegrated past. It's the past that we have not integrated and dealt with. It blocks the future. It takes the road behind us and places it in front of us and calls it the future. He uses a metaphor of water to describe the dynamics. He says, the dark water of the collective shadow becomes a way station for unresolved conflicts, multi-generational suffering, unhealed trauma. It generates patterns of human behavior and consequence, from recurring toxic relationship patterns to poisonous social histories. These repetitions are the silent summoning of our past, unhealed injury, unexamined failure. These patterns are an ancient undercurrent in human affairs, but they can be healed, and we must integrate all that we have been in order to evolve, to grow, to thrive. In my work in Central America with human rights defenders, environmental defenders, and at Red Horse Center for Collaborative Leadership right here in Fenville, I see people doing this healing work, integrating personal and collective trauma and shadow, diving down into those subterranean lakes, meeting whatever is encountered there with presence, integrating what is found. Shadow energy becomes transformed. The abyss can become a well. Trauma stories transform into thrive stories. Futures are freed. Thomas Hubel says, when we integrate our past and our trauma and our brokenness, it creates a ripple effect, releases light and energy that was previously held in shadow, now available to create an authentic future, which is original and doesn't repeat the past. Pat McCabe, she says the hardest thing for her in working with young people and with leaders is that they say, yeah, but really look at this mess, isn't it too late? And she says that despair is real, it's important to contact it, but not to get stuck there, to keep going. She says what she tells them is, remember that this universe is humming with life-giving possibility. The essential impulse is to grow, to evolve, to thrive. It matters what we do with our lives. So for times like these, I make it my practice to return to Pat's question several times a day. How can I be that human being that lives in such a way that my life supports our collective thriving? And for those days when it definitely seems way too late, I keep this little poem in my back pocket. It's by David White. He says, those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. This poem is my GPS. When I panic and want to give up and don't know where I'm going, it says, keep going. You will contact source, secret water, cold and clear, where future runs free. It says, remember, you're not alone. So many fund this journey to a place where we can all thrive. They leave their coins, their energy, their light, and when you falter, look for them in the dark water. It matters what you do with your life. So I want to share a few of these coins with you. The first few come from Honduras, and I feel like I owe you all these. See, three, because you accompanied me through a lot of shadow. The first coin is the people of Honduras in resistance that have been part of this resistance movement for 12 years. You'll remember that in 2009, the U.S. backed a military coup in Honduras and then intervened in every subsequent election to make sure that coup was not reversed. The result was 12 years of violence and trauma, an enormous subterranean lake of shadow water. But against all odds, this January, the people of Honduras reversed that coup, restored democracy, made the impossible possible. Xiomara Castro, the wife of the president who was ousted in 2009, was inaugurated as the first woman president of Honduras. Yeah. And in the period between her election last November and her inauguration this January, she led a bottom-up consultation process across the entire country, consulting all sectors. And she said, what is your priority? What do you need to thrive? And based on all of that input, she developed a 22-point governance plan that's rooted in human rights and environmental justice. And at her inauguration, she read it back to the people. And this inauguration happened in the National Stadium, and she had worked with artists from around the country to create murals. And these murals were erected on the top rim of the stadium, so these huge panels were up on the top. And they depicted the popular struggle in Honduras from colonization to present. And the faces of those who have lived their lives so all could thrive, who left their coins, their energy, their light, were remembered and they were present and they were looking down on that historic moment. COFADE, which is the Committee for the Families of the Disappeared, with which we work and we accompany in Honduras, were present with a delegation of over 300 people in that inauguration. They were given seats of honor, usually reserved for the state security forces that disappeared their loved ones. And they led a procession around that stadium, carrying the faces and the names of their dead and the disappeared from the 80s, from the 70s, from the 60s, all the way till the present. And all those who died in those 12 years of resistance after the coup. And they said that that public acknowledgement was reparation. And after the oaths and the speeches, President Xiomara made her way through this enormous crowd. And waiting for her at the very end, right before the exit, was the daughter of Berta Cáceres. And there she stood with the barra, the Gran Barra de Autoridad. This is the big staff of authority of the Lenca people. And she embraced the new president and gave her the staff of authority, which in Lenca culture is given to a leader recognized by the community, and it bestows on that leader the responsibility to govern so that all life can thrive, to uphold their part on the sacred hoop. For weeks, we basked in this light. This new day, people said after 12 years of long night of a tunnel without an end, they finally saw the horizon. After 12 years of wishing for something else and struggling through that dark lake, people had reached that secret water, cold and clear, where their future can run free. Coin number 2 is the new Minister for Human Rights in Honduras. Tom and I had been invited to the inauguration, and we decided not to go because we had a trip to Nicaragua, and with COVID, everybody got COVID at the inauguration, so it was a good choice. Anyway, so we were watching from home, live streaming on our computer, and just thrilled and crying and happy at the same time. Our accompaniment team was there in the stadium accompanying the families of the disappeared. It was so surrealistic, and then they came to the part where they were swearing in the cabinet members, and they're going through ministry after ministry, calling up the cabinet members, and they call the Minister of Human Rights, and they call the name Natalie Roque Sandoval, and, I just wanted to transport myself to that stadium. Natalie is a dear, dear friend, and I just wanted to be there and give her a big hug and say how proud I was, and so I just texted her. I said, well, she'll see it 6 months from now when things finally slow down, and she'll know I saw her. And to my surprise, pop, I get this text right back. It's a voice message, and I'm watching her on the the tarima, the podium, getting sworn in, and she's voicemailing me back, and she says, immediately, she's like, Jenny, my dear Jenny, she says, my first act as Minister of Human Rights was to have a confrontation with the Secret Service for Vice President Kamala Harris, who attended the ceremony. They didn't want to allow the Lenca to enter the stadium with their vara de autoridad, or the families of the disappeared with their signs of their dead and disappeared. They said it was a security risk. And I said, it's an issue of human rights and environmental rights and indigenous rights, and they will be upheld by this government, and they are coming in with their signs, the names of their dead, and the staffs of authority, and they will not be denied these rights. And they did. And a word about Natalie. Her parents were revolutionaries. They had to flee the country in the 70s when she was just a little girl, because they were targeted by the US national security doctrine. Natalie was born in exile. All through the 80s, they could never return. She grew up in Nicaragua. Her parents worked for the revolution there. Her uncle led a column of people back into Honduras to try to work for change. With him was Joe Carney, a US Jesuit. They were all captured by the Honduran military. Joe Carney was forcibly disappeared, remains missing. Her uncle was executed. They were targets of US counterinsurgency. Her family was marked politically, and she lived from exile to exile. Her appointment as Minister of Human Rights in Honduras transforms this historic abyss into a well. Coin number three. There has to be a horse in here somewhere, right? There is. So in the middle of those 12 long years, when Natalie had to flee again into exile and was in Nicaragua, she was not thriving. She was struggling to even want to live, and nothing helped. And then she found this broken down street horse on the side of the road, discarded. It had been worked too hard for too long. Bones and sores, barely alive. But Natalie saw something in that glimmering in that broken horse. And she got him to stand, to bear his own weight, and she took him home, which was not really her home. It was the home of another family in exile who had very graciously brought her in, and it was not a house that was suitable for keeping a horse at all. But just as graciously as they had accepted Natalie, they accepted the horse in the hopes that her love for him might help her want to live too. His name was Danny. And it was a labor of love on all sides. Natalie would get up early in the morning, go out and cut grass with a machete and bring him grass. She hand-stitched coverings to keep the flies off of his sores. She got vets to donate services. So strong was the bond that Donnie got better, and she would take him out to walk and graze the neighborhood. But the old owners had gotten word that the horse was better. And one day, when everybody had been out for a while, Natalie came home and the horse was gone. She was beside herself, but the neighbors told her where to look. And she flew into action. She went to the police. She pled her case. They deployed two police officers on motorcycles, and off they went into the barrio where the neighbors said she would find that horse. But how to find him in this urban sprawl? It was impossible. It was too late. But she got off the motorcycle and she started walking the streets, calling his name at the top of her lungs with all of his heart, with these police officers trailing along behind her. And Donnie called back. He started whinnying back with this shrill whinny, answering her calls. And so they followed and they tracked his calls, wound through the barrio, and they got closer and closer and they found him. He was hidden deep inside. And the police confiscated the horse, and they authorized Natalie to be his guardian and said, take him home. So I helped Natalie find a permanent home for Danny and a sanctuary for rescued horses. Natalie went on to get her doctorate's degree in historic memory and human rights and went back to Honduras to teach, to reverse the coup, to restore democracy, and she is now the Minister of Human Rights. So when people hear the story of Danny, they say, Natalie, you saved that little horse's life. And she says, no, make no mistake. He saved mine. That little horse gave all the energy, the light, and the coins he had to free both of their futures. There's a little coda to this story. Since I got back to the States, Natalie has so wanted, she's been longing to come and visit and be with the horses here. But she could never get a visa to come to the United States. Impossible. But Natalie has a visa now, and it's diplomatic, and she's going to come see these horses. Yeah. Coin number four, Berto Oliva, director of the Committee for the Family of the Disappeared. I've spoken about her before here. This is a human being who has put more coins than almost anyone I know into the lakes of collective shadow. And this May, the Committee of the Disappeared was notified by the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights that a case they had first presented 20 years ago about some murders that had happened 33 years ago was going to trial at the Inter-American Court for Human Rights. And it involves the 316 Battalion, a military death squad set up by the US Embassy in the 1980s under the framework of national security doctrine. The 316 Battalion was set up to torture, assassinate, and forcibly disappear leaders of the political, student, and popular organizations and unions identified as people in opposition to the government and US interests. This was an emblematic case going to the court. They had 2 weeks' notice to prepare. Emblematic means it stands for many other cases. So if they win this case, it helps justice in many other cases. So on May 11th, the Inter-American Court found the state of Honduras responsible for human rights abuses committed by the 316 Battalion. The state attorney for Honduras was present. This is the new government of Xiomara Castro. And acknowledged full responsibility, apologized to the family, pledged that the government of Honduras would make reparative measures, including public apology, the adoption of measures to protect fundamental human rights, demilitarization of public security, and separation of police and military functions. After 33 years, people who wished and struggled for something else got justice in this emblematic case, and a commitment to systemic reparation from a government put back into people who struggled 12 years to reverse an illegal coup. The 316 Battalion is also part of the collective shadow of the United States, and partners in Honduras are waiting for the US to do its part too, to integrate and transform shadow so the future can be free of it. Coin number five is Berta Cáceres, water protector, Goldman Environmental Prize winner for her protection of the Rio Gualcarque that was threatened by a hydroelectric dam to generate energy for a mining project to deforest mountains and strip the land. But thanks to sustained, and she was murdered, as you all know, for her work, thanks to sustained national and international pressure and deep diving into the collective shadow behind her murder, there are 8 men who have now been convicted. Several of them are former US-trained military officers. And investigations are ongoing into the thick web of national and international bankers and investors in this emblematic case. Her attorneys say that her case is unmasking the criminal actions of so-called development and green banks that invest in and finance corruption, violence, and the violation of human and indigenous communities around the world. People say Berta is in that river and it is full of her coins, her energy, her light, and she's protecting it until full justice is done so that all life can thrive. Coin number six. Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi, chair of the January 6th committee here in the United States. And for the careful investigation that they are doing into the insurrection, the coup attempt this year here in the United States, for taking a deep dive into our nation's collective shadow to look without flinching at what has been described as the first attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812 and the greatest domestic attack on our democracy and country since the Civil War. Friends and partners in Central America are encouraged by this rare act of shadow work in the United States, and they hope that as a nation we dare someday to also look deep enough to hear testimony, to see evidence, to honor the coins of tens of thousands in Latin America and the Caribbean who struggle and wish for something else and are targeted by U.S. counterinsurgency operations and coups to this day that are carefully planned, resourced, and involve a lot of work, as John Bolton, former national security advisor for Trump, recently boasted on major media. Perhaps then there could be a deeper healing and a truer restoration of democracy. Coins 7 and 8, on this day, August 28th, 1963, 250,000 people marched in Washington, D.C. to hear Dr. Martin Luther King, a man who wished for something else with his whole life. And on this day, Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech. That march was coordinated by another man named Bayard Rustin, a closeted gay man. Rustin had less than 2 months to organize what was the largest demonstration this country had ever seen. He was a master organizer, a political intellectual, a pacifist. He served time in prison for refusing to register for the draft to fight in Vietnam. He created the first freedom rides challenging segregation on interstate buses. These men and the movement they were part of for racial and economic justice, this movement that continues to this day, has left us with a wealth of coins and light and energy and continues to show us what it means to be human beings whose lives support our collective thriving. So on those days when it definitely feels too late, I pull that poem out of my pocket. I slip beneath the surface of grief, turn down through its black water, past the place where we cannot breathe and find that secret water cold and clear. These are a few of the coins of human beings and their thrive stories that I find glimmering in our collective shadow. And then I keep going. So I want to close with this from Amanda Gorman. First ever National Youth Poet Laureate of the United States, youngest person ever to deliver an inaugural poem. She wrote this after Uvalde massacre. Everything hurts, our hearts shadowed and strange, minds made, muddied and mute. We carry tragedy, terrifying and true, and yet none of it is new. We knew it as home, as horror, as heritage. Even our children cannot be children, cannot be. Everything hurts. It's a hard time to be alive, even harder to stay that way. We are burdened to live out these days while at the same time blessed to outlive them. This alarm is how we know we must be altered. We must differ or die. We must triumph or try. While hate cannot be terminated, it can be transformed into a love that lets us live, that lets us thrive. May we not just grieve, but give. May we not just ache, but act. Maybe everything hurts, our hearts shadowed and strange, but only when everything hurts may everything change. Thank you.